going down, man? It's the Donnie Houston Podcast. I am Donnie Houston. Check it out, man. If you're watching, you're not a subscriber, hit the subscribe button, man. Turn your likes on, turn the alerts on, all that. You know what I'm saying? Hit the like button. If you are subscribing, you watch it, man. Invite somebody to the channel, man. Let's get this thing going so we can get this Houston history out, man, to as much people as possible, man. All the historians, shout out. Check it out, man. We got a very special guest today. This man's name has been mentioned as... And this is how I heard his name. It was the first time I was introduced to anything about him, man. When I heard of Charles Washington, I was told that he was DJ Screw's only manager. And I got him in the building today right now. Charles Washington, what's going on,
hey,
man?
Hey, what's going on, brother Donnie? It's good to be here, man. It's not too many people that reach out to me. You know, number one, I was low key. You know, I was always in them streets about the business, not about the fame.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I appreciate you inviting me out here, man.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you coming through, man, for sure. So, man, just tell me, man, a little bit about yourself. Are you from Houston?
Yeah, I'm from Houston, born and raised here in Houston. You know, Sunnyside, South Park.
Yeah.
You know, been, you know, Houston basically for 55 years. You know what I'm saying? So I'm, you know, Houston born, Houston bred.
Yeah. So what were you doing that kind of before even led you up to have an opportunity to work with somebody like DJ Screw, like on the business side of things?
Oh, man. Well, you know, my family, we've always had that entrepreneur spirit. And my daddy actually wanted me to be a doctor. And for a while I entertained that, but when after working in the hospital industry, didn't like the blood and guts, so I said no, that wasn't for me.
Yeah.
And so then, you know, back in the 80s, my little brother and he had a little rap partner named Sean Austin, Trouble House and Great Black Shark, and they formed a group called Image Nation, IMG, or at first it was probably LOD, Legion of Doom, one of the two. But in them days, it was basically the MC and a DJ. So they came to me and asked me to manage, you know, them. I didn't know anything about the business, but from there was where I developed my passion for the business side of music, you know, because I can't rap, can't sing, I can't string a guitar or nothing.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? But I love the business side of it. And, you know, so that's how I came into the industry. Was through my little brother and his little rap partner.
Yeah. Okay. And so and what year is this? This is in the '80s still?
Yeah. This had to be in 87, 86.
Mid-80s.
Gangsta rap was just coming on the scene and, you know, still about fun and, you know, and social conscious rapping was still, you know, the norm. But gangsta rap was just rearing his head in that era.
Yeah.
And right.
So, okay. At what point do you actually start meeting DJ Screw and all that?
That had to been, you know, we have conflicts on that. I say between 88 and 90, my little brother say about 89, 91 was when I actually met him through. We had a little partner, his name was Winnie Fufu is who I call him. And I asked him, you know, him and his brother Tootie, y'all know any DJs? Because we need a DJ for the group. And they were like, man, we got this cat. I know this cat, he went to Sterling with me. His name is DJ Screw. And I'm like, DJ Screw? And I said, okay, well, give me his number. So I called him up. We had landlines back then. We didn't have cell phones. I called him up and talked to him, and he said, well, you know, he gave me his address, 10201 Quail Meadows, I believe his apartment, 100 maybe.
100, yeah.
Yeah. And so I come over there and knocked on the door, and he let me in. His DJ system was set right there by the door. And over by the bar area was ALD, right? So this was my first meeting with the cats, you know. And I'm looking at his system. And I'm like, God damn, to myself. I'm like,
so you meet Screw and LD at the same time?
At the same time, yeah. Right. They were both in the same, at the apartment at the same time. So that's how I met up with him. That's what led up to me meeting a Screw and LD.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when y'all first meet, does he become the DJ for the group, or is it just a meeting that just
came? It was a meeting at first, but then he eventually became the DJ for the group. But he was with HBU a few years before that. So this was not his first rap group that he was with. But it was one of his first. He didn't really mess around with that many rap groups as far as my knowledge. It's HBU and then there was LOD. And I know we didn't do anything. We only recorded a few songs before we realized that, you know, we just really didn't have the knowledge. You know what I'm saying? It takes knowledge. You got to understand the business side of the business, of entertainment. And so that's basically, the format that reason why we hooked up with Screw and how we hooked up with Screw.
Yeah, yeah. And so at what point does it become like a working relationship between the two of y'all?
This happens a few years later. I'm at Club Boomerang. Maybe it was Boomerang by this time. It used to be a club called Soca Village. It was the hottest club, and he used to not put that club together.
What was Soca Village at?
4530 Holmes Road.
Come on,
right there in the hood, Sunnyside. It was the hottest club in Houston. It held over 2,000 people, and we promoted shows, concerts from everybody from Lauryn Hill to Ice Cube.
No shit.
You know what I'm saying? Yes. Back in them days, whoever was hot, that's who we did. And Screw was based actually one of the first American DJ because it was a soca club at first for the West Indians. And the owner of the club wanted to turn it from West Indian soca to hip hop. So he come to the other club that me and Screw was at, which was called Club New Jack, one of Ray Barnett's joint, that me and Screw was actually in partnership with. And he asked, you know, would come over and ask us to come to his club and, you know, and turn it from soca to hip hop. And, you know, some things happened between us and Ray, and so we packed up and we went to Soca Village.
Y'all had a disagreement or something?
With me and Ray Barnett and Screw, we had a disagreement. You know, it's always about that money, that dollar bill.
All right.
And so we left him and took our clients, our customers, because we were the promoters of the club, so they gonna follow the promoter. You see what I'm saying? They ain't not gonna stay with the club, they gonna come with the promoter. So I brought them everybody from Club New Jack, which was the hottest after hours joint. It only held like 155 code, but it could be anywhere from 3,000 to 4,000 people around the circumference of the club, you know, every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday back in them days, you know what I'm saying? It was the spot to be. And so I took that crowd, brought them to Soca Village. And Screw was basically the first American DJ. But he didn't stay there long. You know, it wasn't his passion to DJ in the club. So he only stayed a little while. I don't know how long, maybe a month or so. And then he went to, doing mixtapes. And it wasn't, regular mixtapes. He wasn't screwing at the time. Mm. Right. And so, that's our introduction into the club scene. Mm-hmm. And so one day I'm preparing, because I was also the bar manager and promoter for the club. And I get a phone call and it's Screw and he's like, hey man, I got this deal with Big Russ, man. Big Russ, owner of Big Time.
Big Time CEO, Records, Big right, Time. Right, right.
And I knew Big Russ because he and I went to TSU together for business and finance. So I knew him, before, I actually had this meeting with him pertaining to this joint that we were going to do with Big Time Records. And he said, man, I need you to come and manage this deal for me. So I was like, okay, because we severed our ties at this time as far as him DJing for the group, you know what I'm saying? So he was no longer the DJ for the group at this time. And so then we met up with Russ and we, ironed out a few things and came up with an agreement, and then that's what led up to
it. Russ actually told me about this meeting. I think it was where he wanted like $400 or something like that to mm-hmm. do the, I think Russ told me it was like where he wanted like $400 or something to do the project.
I don't remember the financial particulars. Yeah. I'm not going to even lie.
Yeah.
You know, that was so many years ago and so much drugs.
So you were you involved, because you had kind of alluded to that, were you involved with like drugs early on back then?
Marijuana which is not a drug, by the way. Yeah. And Hennessy was our thing. Marijuana and Hennessy.
He just smoking this and drinking Hennessy at this time. Yeah.
At that point.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? You know, and so we ironed out the deal and we put out that All Screwed Up, part one and part two. And that hit pretty good, hit pretty well, so much so that it created a buzz in the industry.
Could you describe DJ Screw at this time? You better describe his personality or like just type
laid
of
laid back.
Yeah.
Laid back. He was always laid back. I've never seen him raise his voice. You know what I'm saying? As portrayed. I'm not going to get into that, but the Screw I know.
You're talking about in the movie reference.
Yeah, I'm not, you know what I'm saying? Or whatever you call that, you know what I'm saying? And I'm not here to hate on nothing. You know what I'm saying? But I lived that. You know what I'm saying? And so I know what I'm looking at. You know what I'm saying? And it's my perspective, from my perspective only, based on my experience, right? So let's get that understood. All right. But he was always laid back. You know, I've never seen him raise his voice. Even in his, if he was displeased, it was quiet. You know what I'm saying? And he wasn't dramatic and deep. You know what I'm saying? He was straightforward and simple. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, based on what I saw in the movie, that wasn't an accurate portrayal of him. In my From my perspective.
Your dealings with him, yeah.
From dealing with him.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Maybe from Nick Nack, which is my first cousin who he dated. They were together for so many years. Maybe that's the way she's, that was her experience.
So are you coming around through the relationship of Nikki as well? Or you had your own, this was separate, how you ended up linking
up? You know, we family. Nikki is my first cousin.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? She met Screw through my little sister, right? That's how they actually met. Was my little sister, me and Screw had just come from maybe, I think, a Soundwave's pick on a Tuesday was when all the new releases used to be released in record stores back in the day. We had record stores. And Soundwave's was the largest record store that you could buy records from.
Yeah, going on South Main.
Yeah, the one on South Main was the one that he liked to go to the most. And so then this day, I think we wanted some home-cooked food. So we go to my mom's house, and she, you know, she cooked. And so then that's what we did. We ate, you know, like beans and rice, chicken, something like that.
Just a good meal. Yeah,
just a good meal. Because we normally would eat Popeye's chicken.
Right, I hear how Screw would always be eating that chicken, man.
Yeah, we used to love, that was our thing, Popeye's chicken, the five-piece special. And so, but this day he wanted to, you know, go by the house and eat something home cooked. And so then, you know, we go to my mom's house and we chilling outside and eating. After we eating, my sister pulled up with Nikki, you know, because they hung tight at that time. And so she introduced Screw to Nikki and Nikki to Screw. And as far as I know.
This is you seeing the introduction.
Was the introduction right there. That was how they actually met. You know what I'm saying? But I'm hearing different stories, but I know what I saw. You know, I was there. You know what I'm saying? And so that's how they met, you know, the way they have it portrayed in the movie, you know what I'm saying? It's a little different from my experience.
Or the meeting at the club and all that?
Yeah. It didn't happen like that, you know. Maybe she didn't talk to him that day, you know what I'm saying? And maybe a little while later they hooked up. Maybe they saw each other at the club. But I don't know, man. You know what I'm saying? That just wasn't accurate to me. Because the way I saw it, they met that day. And it seemed like they was home from then on. You know?
Yeah.
Figure.
So then, okay, so y'all do the All Screwed Up. So then y'all meet with Russ again to do the 3 in the morning.
Right.
And this is the big dog. You know what I mean? This is the album.
Well, the 3 in the morning, even though we didn't know what the name of it was going to be, but that was already negotiated in the first meeting. If this one does good, we'll go and do it. We'll do another one. Hmm. You see what I'm saying? But we didn't know what it was going to be when we were negotiating.
It was just an option, but what that option was going to be was...
Right. So that's why most of your contracts or all your negotiations happen in the industry. Some of them could be six options, which are six albums or a lifetime. You see what I'm saying? Depending on how that artist works his work ethics, his or her work ethics, can determine how long they could be on that contract.
Yeah. When Screw was doing All Screwed Up, were you with him any time when he was putting that together?
I was there with him 100%. I was Uber before there was Uber. You know what I'm saying? I ain't know the dude could drive when I heard he had got his Impala, because by then we had split up. And I heard he was driving, you know, when I got him a car, and I'm like, God damn, I ain't know the dude could even drive. Because I would pick him up a lot, you know what I'm saying? Quite sure other people would too. But I know for the recordings, you know what I'm saying, that was me that was picking him up, taking him to the recording sessions.
So did he do All Screwed Up with Maestro as well? I know he did 3
Maestro's
in the morning.
Okay, uh-huh. Okay. Everything was done at Maestro's. Right.
Is there anything that sticks out from the All Screwed Up session before we start about 3 in the morning? Anything stick out from All Screwed Up?
Yeah. I believe we had one session where Point Blank, I think this was on the All Screwed Up, he wanted a live sex scene. So he had brought a female in. And, he had relations with her in the studio to get the sex sound.
No shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one thing. That's one thing I remember. From
I think
the
that's
All
on what was it, on High with the Blankster? Maybe I think he might.
Probably so. I can't remember what.
No
song.
Shit.
Yeah, that's.
So
one
he going handling his business. Y'all just recorded and then just use it for.
Yeah,
the song.
They recorded it while he was handling his business because he wanted that authentic sound. So that's one thing that stood out for me on that All Screwed Up was the that particular situation.
I gotta ask Point Blank about this. Yeah, he was just here yesterday. That's crazy.
Right.
Man, okay, so y'all go do 3 in the morning, and y'all had to do it so many times. Talk about that, because he had one version already first, right? Or did he start when he said y'all doing 3 in the morning?
Well, when I dropped him off for the first session of 3 in the morning, I dropped him off that evening, and I came and picked him up that next morning. He come out the studio, and he just chunked the dat to me. He said, man, you can have this shit. I'm like, what's going on, Screw? What's wrong? He said, man, I just don't like it. And I don't remember too much of our conversation after that. I just know I had a dat that he threw to me of something that he recorded pertaining to 3 in the morning. And I gave it to my little brother, who I call the gatekeeper, because he keeps a lot of old stuff. And I hadn't thought about it no more until we did a reveal on it yesterday at Sugar Hill Studios. I did the reveal live, you know what I'm saying, for the Screw fans on the Screw page, those that wanted to see.
Yeah.
Which I was going to do anyway, but I just said because I gave my word that when I do it, I was going to let them know. You know what I'm saying? So that's what happened. You know what I'm saying? Just so happened that 3 in the morning, that is jacked up, you know? So I'm getting it digitally transferred. You know, they got to play with it and work on it and see if they can retrieve the data off of it. You know what I'm saying? So I'm waiting on that result right now. I'm waiting on that to be done now. And that may be the very first version of a 3 in the morning. I'm hoping and praying. But on the label, it says 3 in the morning, Pimp the Pen radio edit. So it could be just that as well. You know what I'm saying? Because when I think about it, it makes sense that he called it shit because he didn't like the Pimp the Pen.
Oh, yeah?
No, he didn't like that song at all. You know what I'm saying? He didn't like the song. I loved it because I was in the streets pushing it. And I knew where people was responding to. So I knew it was a hit. You see what I'm saying? Because I was in the street with the people. And every time because we didn't have CDs back in the days. I had cassettes. And they would always rewind back to that Pimp the Pen, like, ooh, that's
so cool. I'm draped up and dripped out. Screw wasn't really feeling it at first.
He didn't feel that. He didn't feel it. I'm just going to be real with you. That was not his song. He didn't think it was going to do nothing. He wasn't the only one, though. I had another close friend. Man, I told him, I said, I'm going to get this song played on the radio. My boy Randy Hanna. Nigga, man, ain't nobody going to play that shit. Man, you crazy. I said, watch and see. I'm telling you, I know what I'm looking at. So I was in the club scene already, so I knew Robert Scorpio, who was the program director for 97.9 The Box. We were tight. And so I got DJ Chill I said, hey, man, I need you to play this song for. I need you to break this song for. This was when DJs would love to break a song just so they could say they broke a song or because they love music. It wasn't about the dollar bill with them. As I've come to realize a lot of what these young DJs are about, they're all about that dollar bill, not the love of money. Not all, but the few that I have encountered, you know what I'm saying? If you ain't got no money, they don't want to even talk to you. And that's kind of ass backwards because you passing over some, you know, some stars with that mentality. You got to get back to the love of music. As a DJ or a program director now, it's all about scans and
your streams
and streams and likes and, you know what I'm saying? That's crazy. When you could have helped a person become a star based on what's in that music. You see what I'm saying? But anyway, so Robert was there happening because they were doing, we used to do live broadcasts. And so he dropped that Pimp the Pen and everybody in the club just went crazy. I saw that happen once before when I broke that UGK Tell Me Something Good. I broke that song for UGK and brought it to the radio station for them when 102 was playing, had a rap format.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm, yeah, I'm the man that brought you UGK. I brought you their first hit that made them what they are today. You see what I'm saying? That's another story.
Okay, wait. Let's get into that, though, before we mm-hmm. go to. Okay. We'll jump back into the screw right. stuff, because you mentioned it. You know what I mean? I don't want to stray away from mm-hmm. that. Talk about that. How do you even get tied in with that?
Like I said, me and Big Russ, we went to TSU together. So we were already familiar with each other. And so I dropped out, and come to find out, he even dropped out. I didn't know. I thought he graduated, got his degree, but he said he even dropped out. But I let him tell his own story. My bad. Russ.
Yeah, no, he been on here. He done told me. Yeah.
So anyway, I dropped out because I stayed too. I played in the game room. Don't do that, kids. Don't play in the game room. You know what I'm saying? But I did that, and they kicked my ass out. And so we had Club New Jack. Screw was the DJ for Club New Jack. And Big Russ comes in the door. He said, hey, man. He said, I need you to get the DJ to play something for me. And so I say, okay, man, give it to me. Because I knew him. I said, okay, let me go give it to Screw. And as soon as he get a chance to play it, man, he'll play it. So the club is packed. You know what I'm saying? Like I told you, it's the hottest after house joint in Houston at that time. So he put that, you know, I'm looking at him. He's listening to it. And then he bobbing his head. That's what he do. He bobbed his head. And one with the, and everybody's like, wow. And everybody started grinding and slow dancing and grinding. Mm. And I said, Russ, boy, you got you a hit. This song is a hit, buddy. Yeah, you got you a hit. And they asked him to play it two more times, back to back. Yes, this is a true story, man. That's how I knew that song was a hit. So had a guy named Kerry Douglas who would come into the club. Kerry was a good dude, but he was a hustler and he had a gift for gab. He loved to talk. And, you know, and he was a businessman. He has the Gospel Truth now. At least when I last saw him last, he was into the gospel thing. But at this time, he was trying to do some, you know, trying to get into the hip hop scene. And he would talk to, I can't remember exactly what he was approaching me about. And so one day, he asked me to come roll with him. So I roll with him, and we go up to Big Time Records. The office, they had just moved into Suite 910, Arena Towers number 2. And I met up. It was me, Kerry, Russ, and his wife, Zena, at the time. And they talked. They were talking. That was his business with them. I was just tagging along. And so then I remember Russ giving Kerry two boxes of vinyl of Tell Me Something Good. Mm-hmm. I already knew what the song was because of the reaction that I saw earlier from the crowd. So we go to 102, and Jammin' Jimmy Olsen was the DJ at that in the evening. He had just got fired from 97.9 for some shit about putting something on fire, and his daddy was a fire chief or something like that. You know what I'm saying? That was the story, the rumors that was going on, or the story that was going on why he had, you know, got fired and he went to 102. So got to keep that in mind now. Yeah. So we go in. He has this. He already had this prearranged meeting with Jimmy, Jammin' Jimmy Olsen, and we bring up a couple of vinyls, like three or four vinyls, and so Kerry's there, but he don't know nothing about the product, right? Mm-hmm. So he's stuck for words, and so I have to take over because I know what I saw. I say, hey, man, look here, this song is hot, brother. I say, if you bust this here, you're gonna do something, it's gonna do something big. Jimmy Olsen's response was, I'll pass. I said, okay. So we got up and we were getting ready to leave. I said, I ain't gonna do nothing but take this over to 97.9 the box. And he said, Hey man, bring that back here. As a matter of fact, go back down there and give me all your vinyl. Bring it all in here. This is what happened, right? So I don't remember if it was that night they played it.
Or when they maybe do the Pump It or Dump It and they do the whole thing the first time they played on the radio?
I don't even think it was Pump It or Dump It 102. That was with 97.9
okay.
with the Pimp the Pen.
Yeah.
I don't think that was a format for 102. He played, may have played it that night as we were riding. But whenever he played it, that was a wrap. That was done. And so that's how they came into existence. That's the true story.
Yeah. Now, I know that radio, I remember being a kid and hearing that on the radio and being like, man, this is.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's how they got that.
That is how they got their radio play. That is the true story of how it happened. I even emailed Jammin' Jimmy Olsen, who don't mess around, think he mess around with it. But I wrote the story down for him, and he verified it for Big Russ more than anything. Because Russ really didn't know. You know what I'm saying?
That's how he even became
what he became.
Hmm.
You see what I'm saying? But that's the truth.
And that was monumental. I mean, that changed history right
yeah,
there. Man.
Yes, yes. Yeah, yeah. You know what I'm saying? So basically, the same thing that happened with the Tell Me Something Good happened with the Pimp the Pen. And it also happened again with a song from Al D called Welcome to the Jungle. Same thing. But, you know, things happened that didn't jump off. You know what I'm saying? And that's Al D's story there. You know what I'm saying? I'm going to let him tell that story. But we fell out for a few years behind that, you know, because I put in some work and things didn't happen the way they should have happened, where he should have had the same result with the Pimp the Pen and Tell Me Something Good. I saw that also happen with a song called Welcome to the Jungle. Same format.
Yeah.
When DJs used to love to break a song. You see what I'm saying? Yeah. And it was not about the dollar bill. It was about the love of music and being the first to want to break somebody.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
So, okay, so now we back to 3 in the morning. Though. Y'all do 3 in the morning. But you said, though, you were like, you know, he had the Impala and y'all weren't really talking about it. But that's still like relatively after 3 in the morning. So what happened? What was the rift that kind of caused y'all to split up?
Okay. We had got a check from Big Russ, and it was for like $40,000. 20% of that for management fees was $8,000. It had been a few days, and I hadn't heard from school. And normally, whenever it come to my money, school would get with me right then and there, or not too long after, you know what I'm saying? I didn't have no issues. But now it's about 3 days, and I'm like, God damn, I ain't heard nothing from school on my little issue, my little, you know, little money. So I go over to his house that evening, and I got my boys, my brother and his rap partner, Trouble House and the Great Black Shark, the guys that's on that picture that's famous on the internet and Netflix. So I got them in the car with me. At this point, they're promoters for me. They're no longer rapping. They're going from, you know, here to Georgia with me or wherever I'm promoting in the streets. They become part of my promotion team. You know what I'm saying? They are very instrumental in the success of Screw too, as well as a guy named Randy Hanna. These three were my main people that would hit the streets with me, pass out flyers, put up posters, because that's what we had. We didn't have social media back in them days. It was hand-to-hand, brick and mortar. You see what I'm saying? No social media. We didn't, You know, so that's the you know, I would get females from strip clubs and have them dress nice, and I'd take them to Atlanta with me, and y'all, you know, pass out these flies. You know, these are the type of tactics that I use to get screwed out. If I saw a quinceañera, whatever, how you
quinceañera, yeah.
And one thing I saw quinceañera, what you call it?
Quinceañera, yeah.
Yeah, and I crashed it. You know, but I passed out flyers and posters and T-shirts and cassettes, and they loved it. You know what I'm saying? I did not discriminate because music don't discriminate. If I saw some white kids walking with their parents in Galleria, I give them a flyer. You know what I'm saying? And so then when I, at his wake, I saw the evidence of that when you saw the multitude of ethnicities that came to view his body. You know what I'm saying? Because that's how it grew. As a matter of fact, here's a story. When I knew we were successful, and this is a true story. I'm in Bel Air, and I'm doing some promotion at Sharpstown High, passing out flyers and cassettes and whatnot, you know, because you have to give in order to receive.
Right.
So we did a lot of giving. And so, next thing you know, I hear some screw in the distance, and so I'm like, "Well, damn, who jamming that screw around in this area?" Because you know it was mostly white kids at that time, you know what I'm saying? And a mixture, but it was mostly white. And so, next thing you know, turning the corner was this middle-aged white couple.
Wow,
I kid you not. And I'm scratching my head. I'm looking at him like tripping. So I go to Screw. I say, "Man, Screw, man, we made it." He said, "What you talking about, man? What you talking about?" So I told him what I was doing and what I saw. He said, "Man, you lying." I said, "Yeah, man, for real, man. I ain't going to sit up here and bullshit you. This is what I saw, man." I said, "We done made it." Yeah, that's a true story, man. But even after that, you could see yuppies in business offices, business parks, jamming Screw. I've seen that so many times.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? People that just, when you look at them, you wouldn't even
expect them to be into that. Yeah.
Right. I'm at a concert. We was at an OJ concert, and we're on the elevator, and this old middle-aged white couple, they had just lost their son, and some kind of way we got into the conversation, and they was talking about, "Yeah, we love Screw. Because our son loved him, he passed away." But you know, and I'm talking to attorneys. You know what I'm saying? These are white attorneys, and they loving them some Screw. So he's touched a lot of folks. Hmm. You know what I'm saying? And it's not just a Houston thing. It's not even just a national thing. It's a worldwide thing on the hip hop scene.
Yeah.
You know, and because you have the national artists like Beyonce, who's probably shot Screw out, you know what I'm saying? The Erykah Badus and the R. Kellys, you know what I'm saying? They've used his work in their work.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? So that's the reason why you see, and then on top of it, his untimely death. You know what I'm saying? Unfortunately, had a lot to do with him propelling to, you know, becoming a legend. You know what I'm saying? I hate, you know what I'm saying, that it happened that way for him, but you know what I'm saying, but we can only imagine what he would be doing had he lived.
Yeah.
You know, yes.
Yeah. So you were saying, you were talking about when y'all went to his house, you were saying you were trying to see what was up the
morning. Oh, yeah. See, I get off.
Nah, it's good. Nah, I'm going to keep you on, though. Yeah.
So anyway, I go to his house, man. Thank you, man. I go to his house and I say, "Hey, Screw, you know what I'm saying? You know, I'm here for my little issue, right?" And it's just him and Al, nobody else. My boy's A out the car, and he goes to his bedroom because he didn't really believe in banks. You know what I'm saying? He didn't trust them, man. He kept a lot of money in his room up under his mattress, like some old folks do, you know what I'm saying? And he come back with two stacks, $2,000 in each, and I flipped through it. I said, "Hey, man, you know, like, this ain't number 4 G's, man. 20% of 40,000 is 8. Where's the other 4? So he looked at me and countenance on, you know, and I'm, he said, what did you do to deserve 20%? So I looked at Al, and Al just put his head in his hand, cause like he couldn't believe what he just heard. And so then I'm looking at Scrooge, you know, waiting for the punchline, you know what I'm saying? The laugh, the ha ha, you know what I'm saying? But it never came. And I said, wow, this dude is for real. What did I do to deserve 20%? I done almost died two times promoting this screw with this North Side, South Side plex. I done had my foot ran over. I done been spat on. I done had flyers thrown back in my face. You know what I'm saying? I done been cursed out. What did I do to deserve 20%? You know what I'm saying? And so then I looked at him. I said, you know what? And he tried to make me like his personal road manager, because I know what happened. You know what I'm saying? That's another story in itself. But, you know, people, the snakes will come out the woodworks. You know what I'm saying? They'll wait till that train start rolling before they want to jump on. And so that's what happens, you know, what happened in this situation. Somebody got the talking in his ear. You know what I'm saying? So now all of a sudden I'm no longer good enough to be his manager after I done put in all his work to get him where we were at. You know what I'm saying? Now, you know, I'm only good enough to be like your road manager. And that was not good enough for me. So I said, you know what, screw, you know, we good. You know, so I
right left. There at that meeting.
At that meeting, it. That was it. That's how we severed our tie. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, when we were riding together, we used to always talk about what we were going to do and how we were going to do it. You know what I'm saying? When we ever we make it. And it took us 10 years. You know what I'm saying? And we finally made it, and then we get one little check. Because that was just the first installment. You know what I'm saying? And I had just negotiated even a better deal at that time. You know what I'm saying? For him on the next project. And you know, and then for money to come in, I don't know if that was the only determining factor, you know what I'm saying? Because I was dibbing and dabbing, but.
This is when you start getting into the drugs?
Yeah,
this when,
yeah, okay. You know, I used to. You
know, how did you trans, because you said you was just like weed and Hennessy, like how do you.
Yeah, even, well, you know what I'm saying? I was in the club scene, and when you are bossing around, when you're a boss, you know what I'm saying? And people want to be around people that are successful. And in that element, you know what I'm saying, a lot of, you know, people are into the drug thing. So I would, you know, sniffle, you know, snort a little coke, did a lot of drinking, my weed, of course. And so, you know, and I didn't have any women, nothing, you know, nobody, you know, stable. And so I would go, you know, do whatever I had to do as far as my business. And if I go out of town, I come back in, I want a little woman or something, I hit them, you know, hit them streets, you know what I'm saying? And you know, they happen to be users. So this one particular broad, you know, it's a nice looking broad, man. I'm high and I'm, you know, out of there. She like, daddy, you want me to go get something? We can smoke, you know what I'm saying? I'm like, you know what? Yeah, go get something.
It's at the island, y'all just doing coke and all this at this point.
This is
before, after, this, he's introducing you to
yeah,
it though.
Yeah. Well, actually I got introduced to cocaine on my own.
In the club?
No, this 10 years before, in like 84, 83, some shit like that. And I called myself trying to sell it.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at how people would always be excited to see my little Cutlass Supreme come on the set. And, you know, and I'm like, God damn, what are they be getting out of this shit?
Yeah.
I mean, I rocked up an 8-ball, and I remember going in the trap houses and watching them put it on steel pipes and glass pipes. And I had a neighbor that had an old car and he had a little steel antenna on it. So I broke it off and put some of my mama's Brillo in it and put my first piece on there. And I was like, wow, this shit is good. You know what I'm saying? So make a long story short, I smoked up everything I had rocked. So
This is in the 80s?
80s, yeah, in the 80s.
Okay, okay.
Right, the 80s, like 83, 84, some shit like that, somewhere in that area. And so And then on top of it, I had to make a choice of hurting somebody or being hurt, because I was giving my dope out to certain of my boys, and they would come back with them dope fiend lies. I didn't know they were dope fiend lies at the time.
But this was going on. Right.
And so then I was like, you know what, man, this shit ain't for me. So I left it all alone.
Cold turkey.
Right. You know, it didn't take at that moment. You know what I'm saying? The addiction didn't take. You know what I'm saying? So it wasn't until 10 years later, in the 90s, maybe 94, when I was back dibbing and dabbing with it, you know what I'm saying? And then they got full blown out by 97. Mm. You know,
but you were saying, you, so you out with this girl and she comes back with it.
Yeah, and then we smoke and
this turns you up.
That kind of gets me back on it. And then I met a young lady and we ended up being married, you know what I'm saying? And you know, sometimes you got to be careful who you associate yourself with. So I had my company going, even though me and Screw severed ties, I still was selling my Screw tapes because I had to connect. I was one.
So the addiction wasn't really affecting like life. You still moving
at one point, right?
Yeah.
But then it eventually caught up, and I lost $1 million business. You know, I smoked it up. You know, sold this and sold that. You used to sell Screw tapes for $10. You know what I'm saying? You couldn't even negotiate with me because Screws was that hot. And they were original grades. You know what I'm saying? So if I wanted 5 rocks, I'd give you 5 cassettes and you give me 5 big rocks. You know what I'm saying? There was no negotiation. I didn't have to spend money.
Yeah. It was understood. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And so, you know, eventually I didn't even have that anymore. You know what I'm saying? So I turned into a full-blown addict. And I walked in the land of the dead for about 13 years straight after that. You know, I've been delivered now for 10. It'll be 11 March 3rd, around 6:30 p.m. You know what I'm saying? That I've been delivered from it, you know.
So you say 97, that's kind of when this is like when addiction is kind of like full-blown.
Yeah, kind of catching, full-blown. Yeah. And I'm depressed because not me and
with Screw thing.
With the Screw thing, you know what I'm saying? You know, he doing big things.
But y'all live across some paths still at this time? Or y'all just literally just on two separate sides?
That was it.
Yeah. But you don't know. I mean, this is Houston, though. It's a city. Yeah. Y'all don't ever cross paths where y'all.
I may have seen Screw when I'm walking the streets at night, midnight. I saw him one time. He was flipping, and he had a little chicken head in his car. And it wasn't my cousin, you know what I'm saying? Because I had stopped talking to her, too, you know. And I saw him over in Yellowstone and near Cushionberries. That was one of the last times that I saw him. And I saw him, he was at a house, down from a house where I was living in at the time. He was down at a house, come to find out that's where he was buying his syrup from. And I saw him from I saw his cat, his Impala from the distance. You know what I'm saying? I didn't actually see him. You know what I'm saying? And maybe the last time I saw him alive was me and my wife, which we were both addicts. She made a lick and wouldn't share with me. So I'm like, God damn, I need to go do something to go get me some drugs, right? And so then I'm walking the streets of Sunnyside.
Trying to figure it out.
Now something told me, say, go ask your boy Screw. He had a shop over there of
Cullen.
Cullen and T-Tarn. So I'm on T-Tarn and Cullen, and I'm right across the street. And he pulls up, and I'm like 99 pounds. I'm hood out. I got on 2-3 pair of pants so I can look like I got some weight on me. Hadn't matted. I'm probably stinking because hygiene wasn't a big thing for me. And so I see him pull up in this Impala. He get out. He's blowed up because that syrup had him blowed up. But he's blinging, you know what I'm saying?
Chain on jewelry. Yeah, they looking good. Yeah,
he looking good, you know what I'm saying? And so, yeah, I can go over there and ask him, man, I know you're going to get me. I knew he was going to get me. I know Screw, you know what I'm saying? He would have gave me probably something that would have killed me.
More than what you would have needed at that time.
Yeah, I would not have needed. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? I know if I'd have come to him, but I did not want him to see me like that. He had went, started talking to some people at some ballers, that was on Swangers, in his part, and I sure didn't want them to see me. You know what I'm saying? So in mid-stride, I turned back around, and that was the last time I saw Screw alive.
Man, so when do you, how do you find out that he passed away?
I was working at O'Reilly Warehouse.
So you still holding down a job, even with this addiction?
Well, you know, I would go into those moments where I would leave it alone so I could try to do something different. And this happened to be one of those situations where I had left it alone, got my system cleaned out, got a job at O'Reilly Warehouse over there for Tavernar. And I'm up on a cherry picker, about 30, 40 feet in the air, get the piece for the line. And my boy Anthony, he comes to me and says, "Hey, man, hey, your boy dead. Your boy dead." I said, "Who? Screw." I said, "What?" He said, "Screw." So I come down. He said, "Yeah, man, come on." And on the radio, I think it was Hawk that was doing the interview, because I don't know if Fat Pat had passed at that point. And I believe it was Hawk. And he was talking to Mad Hatter in that morning, early morning, when Mad Hatter had the morning show. And it was somber. It was, you know, real somber.
No, it rained that day. I remember when DJ Screw
died. Yeah, it probably, because I was in the warehouse, so I don't know if it was raining or not, but I was in the warehouse. And I'm listening. Man, my heart just sank when I heard the words, you know what I'm saying? I can't remember what they were saying, but it confirmed that Screw had passed. So I had walked back to my cherry picker, went up top, man, and, man, I just let it go as quietly as I could. You know what I'm saying? I just, you know, I had to hold it until I got to my cherry pick and I went back up, you know what I'm saying, and just let it go for a few minutes, you know what I'm saying? But I knew I had to cut it short because I was on time frame with, you know, getting this order together. Yeah, so that's how I found out Screw had passed, and that's where I was at, you know.
So, okay, but... Because you said 13 years into the addiction, and it's weird. I ain't gonna say weird, but it's very interesting that you remember the exact time. Like
certain things, I can't remember. A lot of certain things.
What moment did you come to say at this time I'm done?
Oh man, yes, I remember that. That was like I say, March 3rd, 2010, around 6:30 p.m. And. I had, you know, I was living in Sunnyside with my wife and her people. And I would go downtown.
Is your wife still into the addiction as well?
Yeah, she's still in there, you know what I'm saying? You know, she'll be all right, though.
Yeah. Oh, you saying now she's still into it?
Okay, yeah, she's still suffering with it. Gotcha. You know, she can get the help through my insurance, but, you know, that's another story. So anyway, after all the years of, you know, relapsing, getting clean for this, you know, so I go, because I used to drive trucks too over the road, but this day, I would always go downtown to the Star of Hope or to the, what's the other place? You have YMCA and something else.
Salvation Army.
And I would, you know, get into the programs or, you know, I would sleep on under bridges and under cardboard boxes. You know, I've done that from here to Georgia. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? In my addiction. You know what I'm saying? And so this particular day, my daddy had just passed. So I was grieving from that. And I did a script and put a little $30, $40 in my pocket. And I was like, in 10 minutes, I was broke again. So I was walking down in Third Ward. I was living, you know, that's where my daddy was staying. I was staying with him, you know, I would stay with him as well. But this, you know, so I'm walking down McGowan and I go to the bus stop and I see my reflection. And I'm like, "God, you said you made me in your image and your likeness." And I'm looking at this reflection, and I do not like what I see. So I walked down to a meeting. Alive and Kicking is a popular meeting for addicts, cocaine addicts and alcoholics. So I go there, and I'm just crying. Because, you know, my daddy, he's no longer there for me to be, you know, go to as a man when I need to man up. So I ain't have him anymore. So this happened to be a man's meeting. And I'm just letting everything go. And so when I left from that meeting, you know, nobody interjects. They just let you, you know, just let it out. And I felt, it's like I floated. You see what I'm saying? I floated out of
there. The burden was lifted.
Ooh, yeah. It just felt light. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? I was dizzy. I felt so good. So I said, you know what? I'm going to go in here and I'm going to go see my kids. They were young, young babies at the time. And so I said, I'm going to see my kids, see my wife. So I get there and there goes the devil in the form of my aunt, which is her aunt, through marriage, my aunt. And she like, go get us something to smoke. Hmm. You know, and so I'm like, well, shit, goddamn, it's free. Let me, all right, you know, she trusted me because I ain't really fuck over people when it comes to situations like that because, you know, you can always get high like that. So I, you know, go get the dope, and my wife wasn't there at the time, but she happened to always pull up when I'm starting to smoke, especially when it's free.
Yeah.
She gets a tripping. Then she burns off to go do whatever it is that she got to do to supply her habit. And I'm looking at this and I'm like, you know what? I'm sick and tired of going through this. So I get to walking out the driveway. And you know, in Sunnyside, they got them deep lots, they big lots. So it's going to take you a minute just to walk out the lot. You know what I'm saying? And my boy Porkchop, he was going to the store to go get him a beer, a guy named Porkchop. I said, you know what, Porkchop? You finna go out this driveway and you're gonna make a right and you're gonna go to that store and you're gonna get you a beer. Guess what, Porkchop? I'm gonna go out this driveway and I'm gonna make a left. And when I leave Sunnyside, you'll never see me back in Sunnyside in this capacity again.
Hmm.
And that was it. I meant that. I go through Sunnyside today all the time, go through it because I still stay in the area. You know what I'm saying? And it just, you know, it's not even an issue anymore.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying?
That's a blessing,
yeah,
man.
That's how it happened. March the 3rd, 6:30, around about 6:30 when that happened. You know what I'm saying?
That's amazing, man.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Man. Wow. Okay, so, I mean, in this day and time, man, is there anything that you kind of wish, like maybe you would have had the opportunity to speak to Screw again? Kind of.
Wow.
To
yes. Wow. Wow. I don't know even if I had approached him that night, because that had to be around about 1-ish, 2-ish in the morning. You know what I'm saying? It was early morning. And I wish I would have approached him. You never know what could have happened from just that talk. He may have not given me any money and gave me a talk, man. Look at you, man. Look how messed up you is, man. And I know what type of man. You never know what type of conversation would have happened had I just went on ahead and approached him. You see what I'm saying? So, yes, that night is what I regret the most. You know, it is because he ended up firing the guy that talked in his ear. You know, end up firing him. I didn't get fired. He didn't fire me. He wanted to move me around. You know what I'm saying? So I probably should have, even at that point, I probably should have said, okay, I'll do the management until you find out that you're dealing with a demon. Then I probably would have got my spot back. You know what I'm saying?
But everybody's young. Everybody inexperienced. Everybody's right, just trying to figure it out.
You know what I'm saying? So that's, yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. So those are maybe the two situations where I think I wish I would have done something differently.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, man, you got anything else before we wrap it up, man? It's been an honor chopping it
up. Well,
you
know,
you,
I'm back in the game now.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Back on the promo game?
I wouldn't say the promo game. I'm putting my money behind my daughter now.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? Because I had lost the passion for the business back then. I couldn't even listen to 97.9. Even watch on the BET Awards or nothing for years. You know, so I still don't really listen to 97.9. I'm old school, so 102 and Sirius XM talk shows is my thing. But I'm putting my money behind my daughter now, man, and she's doing, you know, making a little noise. So I'm trying to guide her and put her entertainment company together, you know. And she's doing some big thing. Her name is Fetty Knee.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? Y'all check her out.
She got a social media or something you want to give her?
Instagram is Fetty Knee. You know, that's as far as I know. You know, I'm not into the social media, but I do know her Instagram is what, at Fetty Knee?
Okay. Fetty Knee. Yeah.
Fetty.knee.
Okay.
Yeah. She got over 100-something thousand followers.
Okay, she popping.
Yeah, she's doing some big things. Yeah, she's gonna be the next. She's gonna be Fetty Knee. You know, got her own entertainment company that I'm putting together. You know what I'm saying, for guiding her and trying to keep these wolves because they coming after. Yeah. So that's what I spend, Longshore, and I spend time keeping them wolves off of her.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying. I just got some wolves off of her not too long ago. You know what I'm saying? And they're going to continue to come after her, you know what I'm saying? And try to give her, guide her, and help her to make the right decisions, you know, based off of what I went through.
Yeah.
Because where y'all trying to go, I've already been.
Yeah. Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? I done been there.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's what it is. Well, man, Charles Washington, man, I appreciate you coming through, man.
Yes, sir, man. I appreciate you having me out here, man. You know, it's not too many people that have reached out to me. They haven't done the research.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Like I said, when I heard that, when the first time I heard it, Charles Washington, that was DJ Screw's only manager. I heard that, I said, okay, I need to find Charles Washington.
Right, right. I wouldn't say I was his only manager, because like I told you, somebody,
might have been somebody right.
After me.
Right. Well, I'm just saying, this is what I was told. I'm the person, though. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, okay.
I'm the one that I'm the architect. I'm the one that brainstormed. You know what I'm saying? To put the shows together, talk to the job rackers, the wholesale, along with Big Russ. You know what I'm saying? Everybody had their
roles.
Their roles. Yeah. But as far as me, this is my contribution to it. You see what I'm saying? And getting out in the streets and letting people know what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Putting the shows together, you know. You know, that was my thing, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, man, like I said, I appreciate you coming through, man, for real,
sir,
man.
Yes, sir, I appreciate you having me.
That's what it is. Well, hey, man, I'm Donnie Houston. It's the Donnie Houston Podcast. Charles Washington, we out.
Donnie Houston.